We believe that alcoholism is a disease and that Alcoholics Anonymous is one solution to that disease. I'm here to bring you the voices of its members. Everyone that comes on the show, including myself, is an active member and has found recovery in the rooms of AA. As you listen, please take what works for you and leave the rest.
I'm Don. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is May 30th, 1994. My home group is the Way Out Group in North Carolina. I got sober here when I first got sober. I used to always focus on what my situation was like growing up, how I felt, and what my parents did and didn't do. Now it feels like a lot of it was blaming my parents and my situation growing up. But going to speaker meetings every Sunday night for about 20 years, I heard hundreds and hundreds of stories. And at one point I realized none of that had anything to do with my alcoholism and the reason I drank and the reason I couldn't quit drinking. The problem is inside of me. It is a disease. And I had no idea till I came to AA that it was a disease that made it so I could not control my drinking. I heard story after story of people whose lives were much worse than mine. Just terrible situations, abandoned, no love in their life whatsoever, no support of any kind, homeless growing up. And then I heard stories of people who had much better, what I would consider just fantastic upbringing with all the support and love that anyone could get. And, you know, my situation was my parents loved me. They, you know, they're things I didn't like. But none of it had anything to do with my drinking, because in all those situations, everyone who is an alcoholic ended up being an alcoholic. And I learned in AA, surprise to me, that it's genetic. And if I put alcohol into my body, at a certain point, my body triggered to where it began to crave more alcohol. And if I drink, I crave more alcohol. And I can't quit. I can't control it. I might be able to quit for this is what happened to me, is I could always quit for a few days, but I could never success. I couldn't go a week without drinking, because at a certain point I would decide to drink again. So what am I going to do about that? That's my mind. My physical situation is if I drink it, I start to crave it. And so I just need to not drink it. But then I've got my mind to worry about. And my mind begins to decide that, yeah, you know, you need to get out of this feeling and get drunk. So I've got to do something about that. And the solution is spiritual in nature, and I discovered all of that in AA. It's very odd. When I was in high school, before I started drinking, I didn't start drinking till I was 17 years old. I read a biography of a famous French painter during the early days, the Impressionist period, Modigliani. And I read his story, and he was what I know now to be an alcoholic. He was a complete drunk, and he had an art dealer that would take care of him and give him money and keep him painting, get him, go pick him up out of the alleyway where he had passed out and clean him up and give him some money, set him up, get a couple of paintings, and then Modigliani would start drinking again and get involved with all of his models. And it just sounded like a wonderful life to me. And, you know, I kind of made that happen. It was kind of an ideal. Now, why I thought that was attractive, I don't know. It's like surrender all responsibility and let somebody else take care of things, and I can be creative. I became an artist, and I've been an artist my whole life. And I thought I had to drink to be an artist. When I started drinking, it became imperative that I continued drinking very quickly. I remember about 3 o'clock, a girlfriend say, I said, yeah, let's get a couple of quarts of beer. And she said, do we need to do that today? I mean, can we skip a day? And I thought to myself, I need another girlfriend. Which I got. I got rid of that one, got another one who was more amenable to my drinking. But, you know, it always came up in all of my relationships. I had a relationship that broke up, and she told me, well, this is a long-term relationship. And she told me the reason was the beer bottles on the nightstand every night, always having to wake up to those beer bottles there. I was like, well, what is the problem with that? I mean, how are you supposed to go to sleep? I didn't understand it. You know, that same relationship, she had a dinner party. This is what my drinking was like. This is how, what I mean, I realized I had a problem with little things like this. I was at happy hour. She had invited some friends from work over for a dinner party. She was quite excited about this. I didn't know these people. So I got off work, went to happy hour, and she said they were coming over at 6. And I was watching the clock. I got to get home because they're going to be coming in at 6, and it was like 5:45. I got time for one more. I got another one down real quick. I just couldn't leave. My intention was to leave at 5:30. Then, you know, I missed the mark very far and sped home, pulled in the driveway and burst into the kitchen. She said, where have you been? I'm still in my paint clothes, a house painter, so I've still got to take a shower and all. And I said, what's the problem? It's 6 o'clock. You know, I thought I had made it, but I knew that that was a problem. Another one where there was a bit of a problem was on a Sunday morning. It was about 10 o'clock. I went with a friend down to the park. And the day before I'd been in that park, there was a big party. I didn't know anybody there. It was just a big group of people that were partying in the park. There was a band playing. I saw two girls talking that I had seen the day before. They said, did you see that bleep? Who bleepity bleep, who was riding a Great Dane around. It was so obnoxious. Well, that was me. And I thought it was funny. I thought I had a great time. I thought it was very entertaining. And I was small and skinny and rode a Great Dane around like it was a horse, as well as a lot of other things. And I was drunk out of my mind, and I had just made a spectacle of myself, and it wasn't entertaining. And that was embarrassing. I didn't go up to those two girls. I went the other way. It was like, oh. The impression I'm making, I don't know the impression I'm making on other people when I'm drinking. I think I'm having a great time. Finally came to a head. My wife now, before we got married, this war probably would have been 89 or so, she said that she didn't want to marry an alcoholic, and she thought I was an alcoholic. And I said, I think this is ridiculous. I'm not an alcoholic. I thought she was being very judgmental. And she said, well, if it's true, why don't you quit drinking for 2 weeks? I don't think you can do it. And I was going, of course I can do it. It was outrageous to think that I couldn't quit drinking for 2 weeks, for crying out loud. So I did, and I think it was like Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, I was walking around with a chip on my shoulder, steam coming out of my ears. And I was just putting off vibes of like, you, I can't believe you're doing this to me. And she called me on it and said, look at you, you're miserable. So then I had to act right as well as not drink, which was really difficult. And finally, Saturday came around. And I got a 12-pack and got into my studio, started doing some artwork, cranked up the music, had it going on. I was being creative, drinking. Oh, man, it was good. And she walked in and said, what are you doing? And I said, what? We said you weren't going to drink for 2 weeks. And I said, no, we didn't. We said 1 week. And at that moment, I completely believed that we had said 1 week, and I knew full well that we had said 2 weeks. Both things were true at the same time, and that is my alcoholic thinking, the ability to blur reality to whatever I need it to be able to make it okay for me to continue drinking. I didn't do that. I didn't say that. Oh, that just happened to me. Oh, then everything in my life, I could twist it to make it okay for me to drink. Eventually, on it was Memorial Day weekend when I got sober, we had a big party. She married me. She married me, and I continued from that point on to try to not be an alcoholic. And I can tell you, it was 4 years of bottled hell, trying to control my drinking, trying to not overshoot the mark, making all these rules, breaking every rule. I'm only going to drink on the weekend. I'm only going to drink on Friday and Saturday. And then I would like go, oh, well, Sunday, I just got to have something on Sunday because I felt so sick. And also, Sunday's part of the weekend. And then I would like go, well, Thursday is really the weekend. I mean, it's just the beginning of the weekend. And so I'd add Thursday, I'm drinking. And then pretty soon, I'm only not drinking on Monday and Tuesday and considering myself to only be drinking on the weekend. And it's like, oh, wait, this is messed up. Other rules, like the time I bought a bottle of, I switched from beer to, there's a chapter in the big book about all the different kinds of ways that we do things to control our drinking and change the alcohol that we drank. I did that. I switched to wine, which was a very expensive way to drink because, I'm a connoisseur. So it was very expensive. I had to buy cases of the most expensive wine. And this is not expensive, but this is a everyday wine was Clos de Bois. And it was a white wine and it's a beautiful bottle. And I said, okay, well, tonight I'm just going to drink the bottle down to the top of the C in Clos de Bois. So I drank it down and then went back in, was going to have a little more. And I saw that I'd gone below the C and I was going, oh, well, so I just got another glass and I finished off that bottle and I opened up another bottle and I very carefully almost, I poured it to the exact top of the C on the second bottle. And I felt very good about that because I kind of have kept the rule. I broke the rule. I broke every rule that I made about drinking. Did it all the time. I would come home from work and I would say, I'm not going to drink today after work. I'd get home. I'm going to have a Dr. Pepper. I'd walk into the kitchen. I'm going to have a Dr. Pepper. I'd open the refrigerator door. I'm not going to have a beer. I'm going to have a Dr. Pepper. I'd see the Dr. Pepper there and reach and at the last minute change my mind and decide to have a beer. And I learned when I came to AA, I was always going to have the beer. there was never a moment in the day I wasn't going to have. All I did all day long was think about how I was not going to drink today. Not thinking about drinking constantly is as bad as thinking about drinking or drinking constantly. It still controls my mind. So that Memorial Day, we were going to have a party. And I changed the guest list to all of our heavy drinking friends from the lightweights because I needed to get drunk. And I didn't want my wife to pay any attention to it. It won't show up as much if I'm around a bunch of other people drinking in excess. And so we were all out on the deck. And my son at that point was 6 years old or so. And I walked out. And he jumped up, ran across the deck and sat down right next to me. And my neighbor who was there said, you know, he watches every move you make. And for some reason, that lifted the veil. And I could see that he saw that every single day I come home from work, I get drunk. Every single day, every single weekend, I get drunk. Every day, I get drunk. If I'm happy, I come home, I get drunk. If I'm bored, I come home, I get drunk. If I'm frustrated, I come home, I get drunk. It doesn't matter what the situation. The truth is, none of those things have anything to do with it. I'm a drunk. And I had a friend who had disappeared into AA 2 years previous. My friend Philip, and I called him up and said, I want to go to an AA meeting. I'd never considered doing such a thing before. I knew what it was, but I wasn't willing to go test it out. I had the idea that AA was about never drinking again. And so I didn't want to toy with it. And I was done. I had to do something. I had tried everything. And I also got into therapy and tried that and tried to figure out if I can understand what is this thing inside of me, this anxiety that I drink at, if I could fix that. Calm that down, then I'd be able to drink normally. And I learned all about that anxiety. I learned all about that ball of tension inside of myself. And it didn't help. I still drank. I couldn't control it. And I knew I was screwed. And I had to go to AA. Oh my God. Well, I called him up and he took me to a meeting. And that meeting, they were talking about making amends to people we have harmed. That's what my first meeting was about. That didn't apply to me. And I came home. My wife was on pins and needles. She was sitting on the edge of the sofa like, going, well, how was your AA meeting? She was like, oh my God, what is he going to do now? She quit paying any attention to my drinking. It turns out she had been in Al-Anon and she had completely let go of my drinking and paid no attention to it whatsoever, which actually put the focus back on me. That program really works. I couldn't blame her. I knew it was me. So she asked, how was it? And I said, well, they were talking about making amends to people that they've harmed. And I was always a happy drunk. I never hurt anybody. And she started crying. And she said, well, what about our wedding reception? And our wedding reception, I thought, was the greatest party the world has ever known. I mean, I had everybody out on the, we got married on the 4th of July. And there's something about holidays. I like to do all major life changes on holidays. 4th of July, I had everybody at the wedding out on the street singing the national anthem and I had a friend actually fell head first into a 55-gallon trash can, and her parents are Southern Baptist teetotalers, and to them, it's very, very shameful to be drunk. And they were walking around taking beers out of people's hands and saying, you've got to drive. And it was very embarrassing for my wife. And I didn't see it. I didn't feel that. I just thought that her parents were outrageous. It was not a day, I realized, about two lives knitting together, me being connected and concerned for her and her life. It was about me getting drunk. And it was painful to hear and to see. And it was the first crack where I saw, oh, I really have hurt other people with my drinking. So the problem was at that first meeting, they read the long form of how it works. And it came to the line, that one is God. May you find him now. And to me, that was like, oh, no, I can't do this. That's like, they're going to talk about God. I know what this is. This is going to be like the PTL club of fraud preachers on church just trying to get money. I have this idea. This is going to be about religion. The meetings all happened inside of churches. It's like, this is going to be about religion, and religion is about dividing people one from the other. That's what religion does. It makes groups of people and sets them up as the good ones, and these are the bad ones. And all the wars that have ever been fought have been fought at some level at religion, religious conflict at the core, and religion's responsible for all the evil in the world. And here they are saying, that one is God, may you find him now. I can't do this. I didn't know what to do. I tried not going to AA for about 3 days, but it was clear I was going to get drunk, and I couldn't bear it anymore. I had a friend that I used to play music with that was a drummer in a punk rock band, and I played in bands, and we ran in the same circles, and he was cool. Well, he was in AA, and so I got up with him, and he said, let's go to a meeting. It was my second meeting. In that meeting, they said the Lord's Prayer at the end. And I really identified in this meeting. They were talking about powerlessness is not just powerless over just alcohol. It's also, I'm powerless about my work and everything in life, and I realized that, hey, this thing is big. This powerless thing is really big. And then at the end of it, there was a young mother there that had brought her newborn baby to the meeting. And she was holding the baby in her arms. And she had the baby in one arm. And we formed a circle, and everybody reached to join hands, and the baby was next to me, and I put my finger out, and still chokes me up. The baby grabbed hold of my finger to complete the circle. So I was joined, and I was like, I think I can do this. Because I'd had a little baby. I loved babies. I loved my son. It gave me hope. And I talked to my sponsor. So I made Gary, my sponsor, this punk rock drummer, always dressed in black. And I told him at one point, the thing is about AA is this God thing. And, you know, the problem is it's just not cool. Instead of laughing or anything, he said, I know what you mean. And he said, do you believe that I believe in God? And I had to say yes, because clearly he did. And he said, well, use my conception of it. And that worked. I did that. Because I did not believe, and I did believe he believed. And I was just going, okay, what I did was I quit fighting, and I decided to experiment. And the experiment was, I'm going to try prayer. I don't believe it'll work, but that's what they're saying to do. And everything that I've done has failed to try to control my drinking. So I'm going to try this because these people are happy and living full lives, and I'm a wreck. So one afternoon, I tried prayer when I was about to, I didn't go into a treatment center. I just started going to tons and tons of AA meetings. And it's about 2 weeks. I wanted to blow up. I thought I was going to explode or get drunk. Something had to give. And that was the first time really surrendered and said a prayer to the nothing, to a God that I didn't believe in. I said, if you get me out of this, I can't do this anymore. And my next thought was, and this was in my voice, but it wasn't my thinking. My next thought was, Don, you don't need to get out of this. You've tried to get out of everything your whole life. You need to go through this. That's not my thinking. I've never said, let's have pain before, and I can go through it and get to the other side. And I just felt like I could do it. I felt like I could make it through this afternoon to the meeting that night. And I did make it. And so I used that one little bit of peace I got from that prayer, and I unattached the idea of God from everything that I had thought before, all the conceptions I'd come in with, and I reattached it to this real thing that had happened to me, this feeling that had come over me. And it began to work in very subtle ways, but I stayed sober. I've had a couple of experiences that like that again that have reinforced it, but only two or three times where I've totally felt the presence of some higher power right here with me. You know, a couple times it's happened listening to fifth steps and being able to identify with someone else's inventory and hearing their story and being able to say, I did that. I can see your pain. You don't have to do that again. You don't have to live that way. To be able to say from experience, the person I was drank, the person I was will drink again. You don't have to be that drinking person again. There's another way to live. Because I did things that I'm ashamed of. I should be ashamed of. And to be able to have tools in the program to go through the steps, and to everyone that I've harmed, to be able to go up to them and make amends, to correct to the best of my ability the mistakes that I've made, and then be able to go forward and not live that way anymore and have the support of all of AA doing that makes it possible, so that then I can live one day at a time, which is what, that's the way I'm living today. One day at a time. But the street is clean. If I make a mistake in life, in any area of my life, I correct it as soon as I discover it. You know, I no longer have this reality distortion machine in my brain that can just twist it to go, oh, I didn't do that. No, I did that. And I need to correct that. I spoke badly to someone. I need to go up to them and apologize. And living that way, I cannot be that person. It's a new way of life. That's what AA has offered me. To be able to help other people, to see, to be able to help someone who cannot quit drinking. And I recently had someone ask me, take it easy. What does that mean? Well, what a fundamental question. It's like I would never think to ask that question. Now, take it easy. What does it mean? I mean, he didn't know. And I remember being in the place where I didn't know. Take it easy. Well, what are you people in AA talking about? Take it easy. Don't you realize that everything's about to blow up? But to be able to have tools to be able to look at, is there something I can change about this thing that I'm worrying about? If there's not something I can change here, then I need to let go of it. If there is something I can change, the slightest thing, if there's something I can do, then I need to do it. But if not, I'm just spinning my wheels in the parking lot, making a lot of smoke, being angry at things I have no control of whatsoever. One of the gifts of sobriety that has happened to me is I did a podcast with my friend Sam. We went to the men's meeting every Saturday morning, and afterwards we would go to the coffee shop and invite other people from the meeting to the coffee shop. And we had these wonderful conversations sitting around the table. And we decided to do a podcast that was like the meeting after the meeting, where we sit around with someone and talk about sobriety and recovery and how we stay sober and what our lives are like. And there were great conversations, so we decided to record them. And we did that for about 7 years of the podcast called The Boiled Owl, which is a big book quote. Look it up. And one of the things that we did was we were anonymous at the level of press, radio, and films, which includes the internet. So we never linked our personal names on any social media to the podcast. So separate and anonymous podcast. And I think that was one of the things that was attractive. At one point, the Grapevine magazine, AA's meeting in print, a magazine that's still being published, if you didn't know it, a member on the board called. They had decided that they wanted to do a podcast, and they invited us because we were already doing it, and they liked what they heard. And so I became in AA as a special worker, working for the Grapevine magazine as one of the hosts of the AA Grapevine podcast. It is such a blessing in my life to be able to interview people now. Before, when we were doing the Boiled Owl podcast, it was everyone we know in our area. And now the pool of guests come from the magazine and from all the board and everyone involved with the Grapevine. And guests come from all over the world. And it's connected me really with the whole service structure of AA in a way that I was not before. I couldn't see it quite as clearly. Interviewing delegates and trustees, the people at the bottom of our triangle, the service triangle, the people who are helping to get AA out there. so that it continues to exist. So that it was here when I got here, and I want it to be here when the next person gets here. That's what the service structure of AA does. I recently read from Our Great Responsibility, a book of Bill W.'s talks, and to the convention, Bill W.'s talks to the convention over the years. And the foreword, it says that Bill and Dr. Bob, particularly Bill, had the foresight to see that they were going to pass away from the scene at some point. He could see his own mortality and what was going to happen, because everyone looked to Bill and Dr. Bob for all the decisions about AA. And they set up some trustees that would talk to Bill, and they had all the fellowship that would talk to Bill. And when they died, what was going to happen? And his idea, and Dr. Bob, when he fell ill, said, "Oh, okay, let's try this." The idea was that the founders of AA would be replaced by a principle, and the principle is group conscience. And that would be the guiding force of AA. And group conscience comes from all of our home groups. My home group has a group conscience, and it's carried to the GSR, who goes to the district, who goes to the area, who elects a delegate that goes to the conference once a year. And it is the conference carrying the group conscience from all the members that guides AA, so that the literature is here. Everything's in place for the still suffering alcoholic to find us, that we still exist. For such a long time, it's been in place, and it's a beautiful thing. I went to the library, and I saw on a rack of, there were pamphlets, and one of the pamphlets was an AA pamphlet that was, it was in the local library, and it said, 12 questions if you're an alcoholic. I was going, I wonder if I'm an alcoholic. I think I might be, but I don't know. Here's some questions. Maybe I should get that. But I didn't want to be seen picking that pamphlet up and walking out with it. So I went back into the library and got a big oversized book. And I came back, grabbed that pamphlet. I checked out the book, and I went over to the rack, grabbed that pamphlet, and tucked it inside. You know, it was big, and no one could see it, and took it out to the car, got away with it unseen. It's beautiful. You know, I appreciate that about Alcoholics Anonymous, that it's an anonymous program, because I was worried about this. I didn't want anyone to know I had a drinking problem. Everyone knew I had a drinking problem, except for me. However, that's the way I felt. And, you know, that pamphlet was there because of the service structure of AA being in place, to be sure that the tools that people need are there. And anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films is there to protect AA from their becoming leaders in AA, who are the important one. You know, you don't want to have AA gurus. AA speaks for itself. And it's a beautiful aspect of anonymity. It's the two aspects of anonymity. It's there for the alcoholic who's still suffering, that feels the shame of being an alcoholic and feels the, you know, doesn't want anyone to know. You do not need to break your anonymity unless you want to. And no one in AA is going to break someone else's anonymity. It's a perfectly safe place to go and discover how to quit drinking. But also anonymity protects AA from big shots. And it's a natural tendency after a period of time. I have all this wisdom. Bill felt this. He was in a constant battle. You know, all of our traditions come from all the things that Bill had to battle within himself. And one of them was big shot-ism, he says. I'm so grateful that all those things are in place. There's two kinds of service. There's direct service, general service in AA. And direct service is one alcoholic talking to another. It's imperative. That's the way our message is carried on. One alcoholic sharing my story. This is how I did it. Come along with me if you want to. That's direct service. And then there's general service. And that's the structure of AA, which makes direct service possible. So the direct service has remained here. We have the tools we need to carry the message. Being a part of the grapevine is being a part of all of that. And being able to interview every week someone different from AA, whose personal story is always a story of hope and recovery. One of my favorite interviews was two delegates who had gone to the international, to an international meeting, and they opened the meeting with the Serenity Prayer. And they gave every person in every language an opportunity to say the Serenity Prayer in their own language. And to be able to hear all those different prayers in different languages all together saying the Serenity Prayer was chill bumps. It was awesome to have that. AA is spread all over the world. People who are hopeless all over the world. I can't quit drinking. AA has a way. And I'm so grateful to be a part of it. I think that's it.
Thank you, Don. I love all the passion in your voice about the grapevine and the work that you're doing there. And I thank you for that. I feel like the more avenues and the more channels folks have to find their way to the rooms, the better. And I also stay, as you know, anonymous on here. And I don't know that I ever thought of it in terms of protecting myself, but definitely protecting the big shots. I like how you explain that a lot.
I can tell you when the AA grapevine called up and asked if I would be willing to do a podcast for them. Of course, you know, it was like a great honor, but it was also like, ooh, I could feel it. You know, I could feel the ego rise up inside of me it's a real struggle. I have to pay attention to that. It can be good. Ego is a good thing, but not when it gets out of proportion.
I feel like in at least in the rooms and this 12-step thing, ego takes away from the humility that is required to do what we do, to stay sober and to help other people. So it contradicts like the premise of the program, which is humility and giving back.
I like the acronym for ego, edging God out. So where does my power come from? It's, you know, it's not me doing it. As if I can just keep that in mind, I'm in better shape.
Yeah, it does contradict my relationship with my higher power. The ego is, I'm either with God or I'm with my ego. Which do you want to be with today? What is that? Like, which dog do you want to feed, right?
Yeah.
So your son is probably about 30 now?
Yes.
Uh-huh. How is your relationship with him? And does he realize that this comment from this neighbor, you know, he watches every move you make. You obviously had been thinking about getting sober, but this comment is made and you physically changed what you were doing to get sober? Does your son know this comment and this experience and turn of events?
You know, he's never heard my story. I don't think he does. I don't think he does. I need to invite him to hear my story at some point. He's such a big part of what enabled me to get sober. You know, my son, well, this is a little painful to share, but he had ear infections, and he would get an ear infection and start screaming at night very frequently until he had some surgery that fixed it. But he had ear infections at least once a week. And it would usually start at 9 or 10 o'clock at night, late at night. And I would be in my studio painting and drinking, really drunk by this point. And I'd hear him start to scream in pain. And I would feel anger at him, like, oh, no. What are you doing to me? Now I'm going to have to drive and get medicine for you. And because my wife's going to be with him, I'm the one who's got to drive. And I'm going to get pulled over for drunk driving and end up in jail. It's going to be your fault. And then I would think that. And then my next thought was like, what kind of monster are you to think this way? What? You know, you're a horrible person to even have that thought. On what? And that's alcoholism, and that battle is always going on. And to realize he knows intuitively what's going on. But I've never talked to him in those terms about it. He's not an alcoholic. It's rather amazing. I always have been very concerned that would happen to him, but he's clearly not. Recently, he had a serious breakup and was upset and was visiting us. And my wife is not an alcoholic, so she had bought some beer so they could have a beer if they wanted one. And I told him at one point, you know, you're feeling bad. You should really have a beer. It won't bother me. It's completely okay. He's well aware that I'm an alcoholic and that I'm in AA and respects that and loves that. He has no memory of me drinking. So at any rate, I told him, you know, it's okay with me. You can have a beer, and you should have a beer because you're feeling bad. And he said, nah. I think I'll go for a walk in the park. It's beautiful out today. That'd be better, clear my head. And I was going, God, I'm still an alcoholic. For me, alcohol is the answer. For him, the answer is to go for a walk in nature. So.
What a normal thought.
And for me, it was perfectly normal to think that he needs to drink.
Yeah. Keep coming back.
Yeah, it's still alive. It's still alive. I've been sober a long time. And that's why staying involved in AA is important, because when I picked up, I believe, I'm not going to remember the exact number, but it was something like my 23-year chip. And I was working in Florida out of town, and I was working hard, and I didn't want to. It was a half hour drive to go to a meeting, but it was my anniversary. And I was thinking, well, I've got to go to a meeting tonight. So I made the drive and sat down next to a guy before the meeting started. He was an older guy about my age. And I said, it's my 3-year anniversary tonight. I'm going to be picking up a chip. And he said, I'm picking up a start over chip. I had 23 years and started drinking. Can you believe that? I sat down next to a guy who was there to pick a start over chip after drinking for 6 months at 23 years, this one I was going to pick up.
Wow. And for anybody new to the rooms, here's that story, and they're like, oh, bullshit, he's making that up. But you're around the rooms long enough, and stuff like that happens quite often.
It does happen. There's nothing unusual about an alcoholic getting drunk. The miracle is every day an alcoholic stays sober. It doesn't matter how long you have. People drink again. If you stay in AA, you will see it.
Curious for all of the artists out there that feel very much like you do in that you need alcohol to connect with your muse and create. How did you handle? I know you have a really good memory because I just heard your story. So when you first got sober and you had to find yourself back in the studio and back creating, how did you handle that transition from doing it with alcohol and without?
Kicking and screaming. I struggled so hard with it. Alcohol was so entwined in my creativity that I couldn't paint at all. I used to paint in the studio and paint on canvas. And I couldn't, every time I go in the studio, nothing would happen. I couldn't do it, and I wanted to drink. And I felt like, okay, well, I'm going to have to just give this up because it's a trigger for me. And I can't do it. And I realized it in my second year or so that I'm giving alcohol all power. I am giving it my creativity. That's how sick I am. And alcohol is not my creativity. And I was reading the big book, and, you know, like I struggled with God. I have no struggle anymore with the concept of surrendering to a higher power. Exactly what God is, I've given up trying to define it. And that's where my problem was. I was always trying to define it. As soon as I define it, I think I've lost it. I really think I need to hold my higher power as undefinable, because that's what it is. It's some connection with everything. And in the big book, I was like struggling with the word God. So at one point I wrote down every instance of metaphor for the word God that Bill uses. And one of them is the great creator. And I've always felt like my creativity came from somewhere else inside of me than me. It appears to me when I really get going. And I love this story. This is a little bit long, but it applies. I had read this from a painter that described the way painting is this way. And this is real to me. It feels this way. When I first start painting in the studio is filled with people. And the longer I paint, they slowly leave. So when I first start painting, it's filled with people. The first one to leave will be my teachers. All my teachers walk out. And then as I paint a little bit more, all of my contemporaries walk out. And as I paint a little bit more, all the great artists in history walk out. And as I paint a little bit more, finally, I walk out. And that's when I'm really painting, when I'm completely in the flow and I don't know where it's coming from and decisions are being made and I'm surrendered to it. That's the great creator. I said, oh, I can feel that as real. So when I did that, I began to make little experiments in the studio and begin to paint. And now I paint, and it is different than it was before. It had to be different But that was part of my problem, was I didn't want to let go of the ideas of what I painted and how I painted and that, and all of that. It was a big struggle. I had to stay in there. And one of the things a friend of mine in AA said was, why don't you go in the studio and do a painting about not being able to paint? So I did, and it did this image of being, that was all locked up and all, and it was like freeing. I mean, it was a good painting, and I did a painting, and it was a painting about not being able to paint.
That's such a beautiful story, and you're a good storyteller. I visualized all of that. Is there anything that you're thinking of now or that you left out that you'd like to share?
Oh, I think I've covered it.
Okay. Final question for the alcoholic out there still suffering, or those that have years and are considering drinking again, what message would you like to leave with them?
There's always hope. No matter how hopeless you feel, AA will work for you. There's always more letting go to do. I have to constantly look in myself and see, where am I resisting? Where am I fighting? Where am I holding back? And I let go of that place. My higher power has never gotten me out of anything, but I have complete confidence that I can get through anything with my higher power and AA and all the support of all the people in AA that surround me and lift me up. And that's there for every one of us.
For more information, read the first 164 pages of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous or visit keepcomingback.net.